Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And of course, if you're out there in the listening audience, why, we ask you to hold your calls until we request them, because right now we're going to be talking to John Stormer. Now, many of you may not remember John, but back in 1964, John wrote a book. It was called None Dare Call It Treason. It sold over 7 million copies. It was really instrumental in bringing the Republican nomination, or getting the Republican nomination for Barry Goldwater. And, of course, that book then was a mainstay of the conservative movement for many years. It still is. It's been updated. It now is called None Dare Call It Treason 25 years later, and John has written other books. More recently, None Dare Call It Education, and the program we're going to be speaking about tonight, Betrayed by the Bench. Now, of course, John's book came out 43 years ago. Since then, he's become a minister, and he is actually retired from the ministry, retired as an active minister, but certainly not retired for 30 years or more. He's every midweek, he's up in the in the capital of Missouri putting on Bible studies, and actually he's in the capital of Missouri waiting to give a Bible study first thing in the morning, as he has for so many years. And it's the influence of one man upon the legislature there and in Missouri has really been immeasurable. And so it's a privilege to have our good friend John Stormer with us tonight. John, thank you so much for being with us.
It's always a privilege, Dr. Stan.
Well, let's talk about your latest book, The Betrayed by the Bench, and why this is such an important book.
Well, the courts and their decisions probably are behind most of the problems that we face in our society today. We can look at, of course, abortion. Over 40 million babies have been murdered in their mother's wombs in the last, since 1973. Going back a little further than that, many of the problems, and we'll get into this and relate these things, I'm sure. The schools of America's in a mess. As we look at, first of all, I think it's close to 40% of American young people under 50 years of age, are functionally illiterate. They can't write a check. They can't really function well enough to function in society. That's the failure of the school. The 50% of kids going into college today, graduates of accredited schools, have to take remedial math, remedial English. I'm here in our capital right now, and there's a bill before the before the state legislature that's causing a real ruckus. Representative Ed Roth has proposed a bill that would require that if a child, a young person, goes off to college and they have to take a remedial course in math or English or one of the others, the school district that graduated them would have to pay their tuition for that particular course. And it's getting a lot of attention, a lot of discussion.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here with John Stormer. Well, Dr. Stan, our guest is John Shormer. We'll pick up the story there, John. Of course, you can understand the rationale behind that, but it's really not going to accomplish anything because the school boards, really don't have the money. This would be put a further burden on them. It's the idea that if they had to put out the money, maybe they'd try to do a better job.
That's basically the idea. That's the approach to get some attention on the fact that our schools are not educating our young people, and they're turning out kids that, as I think it was Newt Gingrich a few years ago said, that a certain percentage of young people graduate that can't even read their diplomas, and they're passed along from year to year, social promotions, and end up, if they get through school, they're disruptive in the classroom. We're facing, there's just multitudes of problems today. For example, the breakup of the family. In my book, Nundair College Education, published a few years ago, we looked at how the schools over the last 50 years have undermined what I would call the 12 foundations of Western civilization: life, marriage, the family, the absolutes, that there are absolutes of right and wrong. And the book, Nundair College Education, that you do promote and have available through Radio Liberty, details those from actual textbooks over the last 50 years, how the basic foundational views of Western civilization have been undermined. And there's just, we've reached the point today, and another thing that I'll be discussing with a few senators tomorrow is, what does the breakup of the family in America costing us just in initially in dollars? The welfare costs for single mothers and it runs into the billions of dollars even in a state like Missouri, and you go nationally and it's hundreds of billions of dollars for welfare. And it goes way beyond that, then. Something that I want some people to do some investigation and some study on is the problems in the schools. If you get 70% of the kids coming out of broken homes with no discipline, then you got to have a teacher's aide in just to keep order in the classroom.
Of course, everything really compounds upon itself. If we could discipline the students, they would not be unruly. We have turned our back on any concepts of discipline. Oh, we can't do that. We have to, of course, we would hurt their ego. They certainly have to feel good about themselves. There are no standards. There is no right and wrong. This teaching of relativism in our classes, the whole thrust of education is wrong. And there's no fear of authority, there's no fear of God, there's no fear of parents. And what we're doing is actually educating for anarchy. And this is not happening by accident, in my way of thinking. This is done intentionally. And once you take fear of God out of a society, why, of course, you leave yourself open for exactly what we have in America today. For those who will not be ruled by God will certainly one day be ruled by tyrants.
And this thing just keeps going around. We get back to the courts again. And the schools are not allowed to mention God. The Supreme Court back in 1962 and 3 said you couldn't have the Bible in the school, you can't have prayer in the school. It's reached the point you can't even mention God in the school. You can't put up the Declaration of Independence in the school. And in fact, if you go into the widely used 8th grade history books, for example, they used to focus on American history. And they've totally eliminated any teaching to succeeding generations of young people as to what makes America different. they've eliminated the teaching that the thing that makes America different than any other nation in history was the concept in the Declaration that says we get our rights not from government, not from a constitution, but that our rights come from God. And the government was organized to make those rights secure. That's the reason why the Constitution was written originally, was just to make our God-given rights secure. And then that lifts, because that's not being taught, nobody raises those questions. When nobody raises those questions when the courts say that's supposed to be looking out for our God-given rights, find rights in the Constitution supposedly to abort babies or practice sodomy, and the circuit just keeps growing and growing and growing.
And so, what's the solution, John?
Well, first of all, Americans, parents in particular, and grandparents, need to get back. For three or four generations, our schools haven't taught, and as a result, we have generations of Americans that have no understanding of our system. And the reason why I wrote the book, Betrayed by the Bench, was to give a tool. Or, now, there's all sorts of people that are against abortion and against sodomy and other things the courts have done, but they haven't gone back and seen what our system of law was based on, which was the Bible, and then the people and the methods they have used to bring us to where we are today.
And of course, this has really been done very slowly and incrementally. A little here, there, a little
there.
That's
right.
And of course, gradually eroding these concepts to the point today where they just don't teach the Declaration of Independence in our schools, and many of the textbooks, when they do quote the Declaration, leave out that part about the Creator and created and why governments are instituted among men, and that's to secure our God-given rights. And there's not one person, probably in 1,000, if you ask them why, what is the function of government, will tell you it is to protect our God-given rights, which is what the Declaration says.
That's exactly right, and there's all sorts of indications of the ignorance of the American people. There was a column in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch yesterday by the person that appears there on the opposite of the editorial page to hold up what seems to be maybe some indication of a conservative viewpoint. And this man made the point that, and did it well, that a survey determined that 85% of the American people felt that the Attorney General, Gonzalez, was wrong and really blew it when he fired those 15 prosecuting attorneys around the federal prosecutors. He said then, in the same surveys, they found that less than 50% of the American people that were surveyed knew who the Speaker of the House was. They didn't, sizable percent, didn't know who the Vice President was. In other words, the news media has beat the drum, and some of the Democrat leadership in the Congress have beat the drum on the fact that the Attorney General has done this terrible thing. Well, he was just doing his job. They've always replaced federal prosecutors from time to time. But it's been pictured that this is a great evil. And the columnist said, if these people don't know who the Speaker of the House is, they don't know who the Vice President of the United States is, they don't know a lot of these other just very basic facts about America, how can they make such judgments on how the Attorney General functions? And it's, in this case, I think a lot of it is the efforts of the news media and what they focus on. And so the circle just keeps going, that there's all these influences in our society that are eroding the foundations on which America grew great.
Mm-hmm. But of course, the major foundation which caused America to grow great was the belief in God, and that our laws were founded on the common law, and the common law was based upon God's word, which was absolute and not changing and by the whims of men.
That's exactly right. And there was a time when Americans understood those things. The head of Harvard Law School wrote a book on the spirit of the common law back in 1920s, and he indicated that they have to be very careful when they start changing the basis of law, because for most of America's history, people had enough of understanding that they'd say, on what basis are you making these changes? But we've reached a point today that the changes are made and nobody even questions it. Or at most they may say, I just don't like this, but they don't understand why and how it's been done.
And because I don't think they understand that the Supreme Court does not have the right to change our laws, because if they do, then we have a rule by man, we have a rule by certainly by the judicial rather than by the Constitution, which every member of the Supreme Court has sworn to uphold. And so if they've sworn to uphold the Constitution and to interpret it based upon its meaning, then of course how can they possibly find the right to abortion, find the right to sodomy, find the fact that they have the right to take God out of our schools and change the entire direction and foundation of the moral beliefs of our people? That's the thing. There's nothing in the Constitution that allows them to do that. So they obviously have a different agenda. And when you have the Judicial Department of the United States that has a different agenda that seems to be intent upon destroying our nation, then no man's life or family or property are really safe.
Exactly. And just a moment ago, and as you started making that presentation, you said the Supreme Court has no right to change the laws of the nation. And that gets back to the fact that this effort to change us from the common law, which was developed in England in the 1500s, and it grew based on the laws of nations and nations' God, the laws of nature and nature's God, and as Blackstone kind of codified that English jurist back in 1700s, he said very clearly that if a judge makes a decision or a legislature passes a law that in any way is in conflict with the law of God, it was null and void. And in the 1870s or so, Harvard Law School and some others said that we don't like that idea, because they came to believe in evolution, for example. And they said that the law has to evolve also. And they looked for a way to do that. And they developed at Harvard Law School the concept of case law. And case law is the idea that any ruling a judge hands down, that becomes the new law unless some higher court overturns it. And that's the basis on which we've come to the place today, basing our laws not on what a legislature passes, but on a precedent established by a court. And as people were interviewed for the Supreme Court today, they're asked, what about Roe v. Wade? And they say, oh, well, that's an established precedent. That's established law. And that has brought us to the place where any five men or five persons on the Supreme Court, by their decision, determine they can throw out an established law, and what they have determined and what they write becomes the new law of the land.
And of course, the thing is, they want to amend the Constitution. It can be done. They don't want to amend the Constitution. They want to use the courts to disrupt America and, of course, to create the moral anarchy that we have today. And I don't believe it's happening by accident. We'll be back.
Well, there were people with names and faces who set out to do it. I've written the book Betrayed by the Bench to try and show how they did it.
All right, fine. Well, why don't you just pick the story up there? Go right ahead.
Okay, and...
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a 4-tape or a 4-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer iOtterol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that'll protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
You got headaches? Most headaches are caused by a structural weakness of blood vessels in the head, and the blood vessels are tending to balloon, causing a headache. The structural weakness is due to a deficiency. Correct the deficiency, and the body will heal itself. I blended what I believed to be the missing nutrients in the right proportions, and the headaches went away. When they were gone, they stayed gone. I named it Headache Stay Gone. See HeadacheStayGone.com or call 800-327-0727 for more information or to place an order. I'll send you a bottle of Headache Stay Gone. Headache Stay Gone will cure your headaches and prevent them from coming back before you pay the bill. Headache Stay Gone has already cured the worst migraines I have ever heard of. Call 800-327-0727. All orders are shipped the same day. Call 800-327-0727. That's 800-327-0727.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Teary. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious-tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
And this young man that killed those 30-some people, he was an English major. He was a senior. And she went into the Internet and got to the web pages of the English professors at Virginia Tech to whom he would have been exposed during his college career. And... The vicious anti-American denial of absolutes and titled the study, who taught Cho to hate? What we expose these kids to, it has an impact. God is denied in most of our colleges, and the literature that they're caused to read, and that was another thing. He was exposed to all sorts of viciousness. We no longer teach the great literature of the past, or if we do, we look to see what evidences there are of anti-women, anti-minority, or whatever in those, rather than just getting the positives out of it. This has permeated down. Of course, it's taught to teachers that then end up teaching in our elementary schools and our high schools. And I should make at this point, and I try to make the point in my book, there are dedicated people. There are dedicated people functioning in the public schools today. They'd have to be to put up with a lot of the garbage that they put up with. But they don't control the textbooks. They don't control what actually is in the curriculum. Even the Christians that are there, they do what they can do, but they're very definitely limited and get into serious trouble if they try to do what they should do.
Because the colleges, they really, many of the colleges will not let somebody who's evangelical Christian in there, and you're not going to be able to get a PhD. You're going to be discriminated against in many of our colleges if you do hold values that believe there's absolutes, believe there's right and wrong, believe there's a God, and one day we will stand before him and answer for what we've done here on earth.
Exactly, and that's another one of the foundations of Western civilization, that there's an ultimate, at least a possibility, that you'll have to answer in the next life. And that is just totally ignored and it's been eliminated from our education, from our media, from every segment of our society.
And I don't think that's just by accident. You, John, don't you think there's been a very intentional effort to destroy the moral fabric of America?
Well, very definitely. And of course, I'm asked sometimes, do you believe there's a conspiracy? And I said, yeah. And it started in the Garden of Eden. And Satan has his agents, and they have worked very, very effectively in the major colleges and universities and those people, then they promote one another and they have a real influence. I don't think that a parent should ever let their children go off to now if they get a good solid foundation. Maybe they're going into engineering. There's some absolutes in engineering, fortunately. 2 + 2 has to come out to 4 all the time, no matter what the crazies that think. So engineers tend a little better to think right, but even in engineering, and I went through Penn State in electrical engineering 50 years ago, and even there we had to take a course in sociology, we had to take a course in economics, we had to take, and they were all bad.
I laugh because, of course, I did the same thing 55, closer to 60 years ago, and certainly I went into the University of California believing in God, and I came out a confirmed agnostic and a liberal, and it's amazing what they're able to do with your mind and how long it takes to unlearn everything you've been indoctrinated in. We'll be right back in just a moment with John Stormer. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening, John Stormer. We're talking about his book, Betrayed by the Bench. And it's really the story of the Supreme Court, the planned program to destroy the moral fabric of our society that has succeeded so well. So pick the story up there, please, John.
Well, I made the rather broad statement that all of the problems we face can be traced to the Supreme Court today. I just come up recently with the fact that we have a lot of concerns about this problem of illegal immigrants and the fact that they come over the border and show up at the emergency room or show up to have their baby here and become automatic citizens then. And I wasn't aware until just very recently that the root of that problem that we're facing today goes back to a Supreme Court decision in 1971. Harry Blackmun, a man who 2 years later wrote the Roe v. Wade decision, in 1971, he wrote the decision in a case. It was Graham v. Sullivan, and it came out of Arizona and Pennsylvania, and both of those states had laws that said that you can't get welfare, you don't have a right to welfare and all the other benefits of society if you're an illegal immigrant, or even if you're an immigrant who's been here a while, until you've established your residency here. And the case was taken out of Arizona to the Supreme Court, and Harry Blackmun ruled, and it was a unanimous ruling of the Supreme Court, that under the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, that anybody who lives here has all the benefits and all the rights of citizenship. Now, they didn't go so far as to say they had the right to vote, but you know there are places in America today where they're permitting illegals to vote in school board elections because this affects their children. And this thing just keeps expanding and expanding. And we have to come, and it's not going to happen until, first of all, Americans' people really educate themselves on what's going on. It's not enough to just be against abortion and say those.
Hold that thought right there for just a moment now. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is John Stormer. And before we go on, John, I'd like you to give out your website, your address. People, how can people get in touch with you and your ministry and perhaps even take your newsletter, which I always look forward to?
Well, the website on the Internet is LibertyBellPress.com. That's just, do it as one word, all lowercase, LibertyBellPress.com. And that would get you to spelling out of my various books, a number of which are available right now, and the single copy prices and some quantity prices on them. They also list there the actually three or four of the videos I've done, which Radio Liberty offer, and I'd certainly recommend that those who are interested contact Dr. Stan and Radio Liberty, and but they are available through the Internet. We also mentioned there and do have a newsletter issued periodically, Understanding the Times, it's called, and we're just, in fact, be sending off to the printer in the next 2 or 3 days a newsletter that we've talked about. Actually, the problem we've talked about on Radio Liberty, what will we really get through the Iraq Constitution that was adopted by those purple-fingered people back almost 2 years ago? And, you know, nobody has everybody talks about those people going out and adopting the Constitution, and supposedly it was to establish democracy, and I fell short. I guess I went almost a year before I thought, I wonder what that Constitution actually says, that our men and women are over there putting their lives on the line to establish, and I obtained a copy of the Iraq Constitution and was astounded to see that it's a very cleverly written document. If you don't understand something about constitutional theory and don't read, I mean, it says that you'll have freedom of the press and freedom of speech and a whole lot of other good things. But as you analyze the whole document, it establishes a socialist government in Iraq, and it lists all the nice things like freedom of speech and freedom of the press and all the things that we think are important. But there's a qualification on it, as permitted by law. Now, the difference between our Constitution and theirs is that our Bill of Rights, for example, says Congress has no right to interfere with the freedom of religion or the freedom of the press. But under this new Iraq Constitution, the legislature can overrule the Constitution itself, in effect. And they do say that all legislation shall be based on Islamic law. And it establishes the Islamic religion as the religion of the state. And then it says that a part of their constitution will be the covenant of the Arab League. Well, I went back and got a copy of that, and basically the covenant of the Arab League, written in 1948, denies Israel's right to exist and commits each of the 15 or so Arab nations to do everything they can to eliminate Israel. And we put together a newsletter on that basis, and if anybody is interested, I'd be happy to send a copy, a free copy. They just write to me, John Stormer, Post Office Box 32, Florissant, Missouri. That's Florissant, Missouri. And the zip code is the real key thing. 63032.
Now give that address one more time, please.
Okay. John Stormer, Box 32, Florissant, Missouri. Florissant, Missouri. 63032. And actually, if you get the 63032 on it, that's probably more important than spelling the name of the city right or anything else.
And I think it's important that we understand what our boys are fighting for.
That's
right. They had a secular nation over there where you were free to practice Christianity or whatever religion you wanted to, Orthodox Christianity, Eastern Orthodox, Evangelical Christianity, the Assyrian Christianity, the Chaldeans, all of these sects are there. Well, of course, the Christians have fled because we've established an Islamic state there, according to the Constitution.
That's right. Now, that Constitution says that Christians and a couple of other little sects have rights. But as you've just correctly stated, Christians in Iraq, any that have the means to do so, are fleeing the country by the thousands.
Because under Sharia law, of course, you have to pay special taxes, and you're a second-rate citizen. That's the official Islamic law position. And everything there is to be under Islamic law. That's what our men are fighting and dying for, that and establish a socialist society.
And again, until the American people wake up and dig in and get the information they need, And then, of course, what can we do? I'm frequently asked, what's the hope? And I normally say, humanly speaking, there is no hope. Unless God intervenes, and God has intervened in America on a number of occasions, twice dramatically, back during the Great Awakening, just before the War for Independence. They had revivals at Harvard and Princeton, and basically it turned out the young men who became our founding fathers. And then again in 1857, there was a real awakening, and out of it came the work of D.L. Moody and the Salvation Army. And if you go to the hymn books that we're using, if I like hymn books that tell who wrote the hymn and when the person was born and when they died, and most of the hymns in a good hymn book, traditional hymn book, came out of that period in the 1700s or in the late 1800s, coming from those revivals.
Okay, first and the second Great Awakenings.
That's right, and God's still on the throne, and we can't expect Him though just to intervene in some. Well, God works through individuals. And until Christians come to the place of being informed, first of all, as to what's going on and the way God is being denied, and then to say to the Lord, as the Apostle Paul did when he met Jesus Christ on the road to Damascus, in Acts 9:6, it recorded his words, where Paul's first words were, "Lord, what wilt thou have me to do?" And we need to come back to that. When we do, we might see God start to work in society.
I agree with you totally. And my friend Chuck Christmeyer, of course, we've had as a guest on several times recently, and he talks about renewing the soul of America. And he said, if we're going to renew the soul of America, we have to start one person at a time, and starting with ourselves.
It's not enough to just to wring our hands and there are those now. I hold to the pre-trib, pre-mill position. Some of our listeners understand that, and sometimes we get criticized by those that don't hold to that position, that say, "Well, you people that believe the Lord is coming back, you just sit around and wait for the Lord to come." But my Bible says that the Lord said, in talking about his coming, "Occupy till I come." And that word "occupy" means go out and try to get control of things, and be the influence in society that you know. When I have opportunity to speak to preachers, sometimes I try to point out to them that if the preachers back in the period before the War for Independence, back in the 1700s, had the attitude towards, "We can't get involved in government, and that's political, and all we need to do is just preach the word," if the preachers back in the colonial period had had that view, we'd all still be English.
Well, John, how long have you been going up to there to the state capital to do your Bible study for the state legislators? How long have you been doing that?
I believe this is the 30th year.
And certainly, you know, Missouri is really one of the better states in the Union, and I think in large part because of the influence of John and the people who've helped.
A lot of other good people.
Right. But, of course, you have to touch the people who have the positions of power. And how many people do you get out to those Bible studies?
We've had this year as many as 35. Sometimes there's committee meetings, and it varies from week to week.
But I think, of course, legislators, whether Republican or Democrat, indeed realize that they are answerable to God. And when you know you're answerable to God, that gives you a whole different perspective. And when
that's
God's
exactly
not
right.
Go ahead.
One of the things that we need, I have a friend up in Idaho who's been mentioning, and I've been thinking about it, that he's looking to maybe write a book on pragmatism or principle. And one of his concerns is that there's a lot of people that have principles or say they believe certain things, but when the pressures come, they become pragmatic in what they maybe will try to accomplish. And we've gone through a situation in St. Louis just recently where somebody took a real stand when it was a public stand on pro-abortion and pro-stem cell research and so forth, and a religious leader stepped up and resigned from a board and took a stand, and other people said, well, how can he do this? This was a fundraising thing to do good for children. And too often today, we simply look at, we're willing to accept the means if we feel it's a good end. And that's never, it's never right to do wrong in order to get a chance to do right.
And of course, if we have to stand on principle, and we really have to stand on God's words, you know, the one thing that I think that people on the other side, you know, really get very upset at, if you get up and you say, this is wrong, not because I said it's wrong, but because God says it's wrong according to the scriptures. And boy, if you want to get to a furor on the part of the liberals, you say that, but of course, you have to say it. And it's not my the way I look at it, not the way that John Stormer looks at it, it's what God's word says. And that has to be our standard. And if it is not, then of course we'll have rule by men, and then of course you have pragmatism. And whatever seems to work, why you go ahead and do it. And that's why we're in the trouble we are today as a nation.
That's exactly right. So first of all, we need to know what God does say. And then we need to be in a position to apply his word to the situations in which we're involved and be willing to stand up and say, God says, not I feel, but God says.
And of course, our laws were originally based upon the Holy Scriptures. Wouldn't it be nice if we knew that we had people on the Supreme Court who would, of course, look to God's word as the source of their judgment rather than how they feel or to how the church feels? It has
exactly
to be God's word rather than what the minister or the priest or the cardinal or whoever it would be actually says. And unfortunately, we don't necessarily always have that.
That's been one of the real problems, that there was a time, you can go back in history, and John Jay, our first Chief Justice, was, I think, the head of the American Sunday School Union, head of a Bible society, and in fact, the head of the first Supreme Court said Christians have a duty and a responsibility to elect Christians to government. And if we had somebody that stood up and said that today, there'd be all sorts of cries and bigotry and all the rest.
Well, of course, we do have a president who, of course, attests to his Christian beliefs and tells that he prays every day and looks to God for guidance. But then, look, how do we get into the mess where we are today if God's really directing him?
Well, that's right. And we have great multitudes of people who have trusted Christ. I remember when the Lord saved me in 1965, at that time in St. Louis, there was one radio station that had about 3 hours of Christian programming in the morning. That was it. I can't count the number of Christian stations and Christian television stations today. Everything that's there isn't good. But people are exposed to a lot of that material. And in those days, I got involved, or the pastor of the church I was in tried to get me involved in saving the only Christian bookstore in town. And I looked at it, and I was a new Christian, but I said, well, if I got involved, I couldn't sell that, and I couldn't sell that. And they said, well, if you're going to be in the Christian book business, you got to sell what people want. And I said, well, life's too short for that. And that store went out of business. I can't count the number of Christian bookstores today all over the area. Not everything they're selling isn't good, but it's an indication that there's a great interest. There was no Christian school movement in those days. There's all sorts of indications that there's a lot of interest and a lot of involvement, but it needs to get informed and really take a stand.
And, Chris, what we need is Christian leadership. A lot of people realize there's a problem. A lot of people realize there's a spiritual problem. But there has to be leadership out there from our ministers and from our Christian leaders directing people, you know, and getting them to take a stand as well. Well, we'll be back in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program with John Stormer and his book, Betrayed by the Bench. Well, John, we've got 3 minutes to wrap the program up this evening. So what are your parting thoughts for our listeners?
Well, I would urge those who are listening tonight, probably faithful to Radio Liberty and the message that they hear there, and I certainly encourage that. But we not only need to listen to the radio, that's good, we need to be reading books, and then we need to be reaching out to reach other people. And a suggestion I'd have, one of the problems we have is we start to see something, we'll run around and almost grab other people by the tie or by the throat and say, here's something you need to read and here's something you need to know. And I don't like to be told what I need to do and what I need to know. I have found over the years that it can be effective if we're informed ourselves and you say to somebody, say, did you see this or that? What do you think about this? And people like to be asked for their opinions. And once they do, it can get involved in a discussion. And then finally you can say, well, what are you doing about it? And what can you do about it? So we need to learn to be more effective in reaching out and educating and challenging other people to stand for what's right.
I agree with you totally, and we always tell people don't try to lecture people. Try to get them to think. I think you learn; they will learn so much more and accept it so much more readily if it's put into a... In the form of a question rather than a dogmatic statement.
Right.
The problem is today most people don't think. Their minds have been conditioned by the medium, and we've got to break that veneer, that whatever it is, this almost like a spiritual blindness. And once people can begin to think and question, why, of course, then we can begin to reach them, not only with an understanding of what's going on, but with the true nature of this spiritual battle that really is behind everything going on. Well, our guest this evening has been John Stormer. His book, Betrayed by the Bench, and we'll tell you in a few minutes about how to get that, and his book, Nundare College Education, his book, Nundare College Treason, 25 Years Later. John, it's always a pleasure to have you here with us. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us, and have a good, safe trip back to Florissant tomorrow.
Thank you, and thank you for what you do.
God bless. Bye-bye. All right. Well, I guess this evening's been John Stormer, certainly one of my favorite people, and we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening's been John Stormer, and of course, in the book, Betrayed by the Bench, John tells the story of when he doesn't mention me, of course, but when he and I were part of a little group that picked George Bush to be the President of the United States. It was a group of conservative Christians who put together in Washington, D.C. to interview all of the candidates. And that one little segment in the book where he actually tells about his question to George Bush, what would you do if you were the President and you were asked to sign a piece of legislation that was unconstitutional? I think his description of what transpired at that time, although a little bit different than my recollection, it gives you tremendous insight into why we are in the position we are in America today. Well, let me suggest the book, Betrayed by the Bench. Of all of the books on the Supreme Court and the judicial system, are there none this good? This is a classic book, as all of John's books have been. But this is the finest book we have on our judicial system, and you need to know the information that's there and the relationship between our Constitution and our Declaration of Independence. And then, of course, his book, None Dare Call It Education. His book, None Dare Call It Treason, 25 years later. We actually carry three videos that John has done. One is What Are the Dead Communists Doing? One goes into the biblical basis of our Constitution. And certainly one goes into what's happening on the educational system. And, of course, you can get all of them together if you're interested in a very special offer from Radio Liberty. So please give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Again, the books, Betrayed by the Bench, None Dare Call It Education, and then, of course, None Dare Call It Treason, 25 years later. John is one of the clearest thinkers I know, and what a privilege it is, not only to be able to interview him, but to call him a friend. So, and then, of course, we recommend certainly his newsletter. They're well worthwhile getting, keeping, filing away, a tremendous source of information, and one of the clearest and most concise thinkers in the conservative movement in America today. Well, of course, then, if you'd like to better understand what's really going on, why we're in Iraq, and why we're going, in all probability, into war with Iran, you need, first of all, to get our February newsletter. It's available on the Internet at RadioLiberty.com. That's the February Radio Liberty letter. It's available for nothing. Of course, if you don't have access to the Internet, would like the February letter, we'd be glad to send you one. Just give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. But you really need, of course, to listen to my talk or read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and then you need, of course, to see my latest talk. It's entitled Forbidden Secret, because there really is a forbidden secret. It has been passed down through the secret societies for 5,000 years. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, there really are secret societies out there. The ancient mystery religions, of course, they developed, of course, into many of the organizations that exist today, the Knights Templar, the Rosicrucians, the Theosophists, the Lucius Trust. Oh, they all have websites. You say, well, that's not secret. No, you can find out about them, most of them. Opus Dei. But you have to understand that most people will never hear of them. They don't understand what masonry is. You want to understand masonry? Why the great DVDs, award-winning, but very professionally done, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning, and the most recent addition to the series, The Riddles in Stone, secret architecture of our nation's capital. We carry the book, but the DVD is far better. You can get both of them and so much more by calling us at 1-800, if you'd like to get more information on the availability of these, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Our website, RadioLiberty.com. Please pray for America and pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, and, well, of course, our guest this evening for the first half of this hour. And as long as he can stay with us, of course, will be Mike Malone, who's a writer who's written a fascinating book called Bill and Dave. And, of course, it's the story of Hewlett Packard. It's the story, well, I'm going to let him tell you, because it's not simply the story of a corporation. It's a unique story about probably one of the most unique organizations and businesses that has existed in modern times. And with that as background, Mr. Malone, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you. How are things in beautiful SoCal?
Well, I'll tell you what, this is about as close to heaven as you're going to get here on this earth. And, you know, I've lived all over the world. I've lived in Africa. I've lived in Europe. I've lived in the Bay Area, Sydney and San Francisco and Oakland. And I've always come back to Santa Cruz, in this area. This is my home, and I love it here.
I was with SoCal 2 weekends ago. What a beautiful place.
It really is. Well, anyway, whereabouts do you live?
Sunnyvale, in the middle of Silicon Valley, at the center.
Right. Well, anyway, Chris, so that's, of course, where Hewlett Packard is, and you even worked for them at one time, didn't you?
Yeah, long ago, right out of college.
Why don't you tell us really what motivated you to write the book, and then why this corporation is different than any other corporation?
Well, I've been covering Silicon Valley and the electronics industry, I think, longer than just about anybody. I believe I was the first daily newspaper reporter covering technology in the world. And that was for the San Jose Mercury News at the end of the 1970s. So I was able to really watch Silicon Valley grow. I grew up going to school with people like Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, and I was on the ground in the first week of eBay and a number of other companies there at Google in the first month. So,
did you buy any stock in them?
As a matter of fact, in a couple of them, yeah.
Okay.
And throughout all those years, I saw great CEOs, I saw really bad ones, I saw companies that were hugely successful but were nightmares to work for. I saw other companies that had enormous potential that cratered. And in covering this valley now for a total of 30 years, it struck me that there's one company that seems to stand apart from all the rest, and that's Hewlett Packard. And what motivated me to write about the company, I have to admit, was a number of years ago, I wrote a book about Apple Computer called Infinite Loop. And that was 2 years of misery, because I was basically recounting the story of a company that had everything. This is right before Steve Jobs came back. A company that had everything, and then it just slowly frittered it all away, and it created a fairly poisonous environment. And by comparison, working on this Hewlett-Packard book, telling the story of Bill Hewlett and Dave Packard, was an absolute joy, because here were two guys that built a great company that's still a great company 60 years later, and were arguably one of the most innovative of businessmen, but also the most enlightened. And these guys did everything right, and they always did it in the name of their people. And that was quite marvelous.
And, of course, would you point out that there was a very definite concern about the people who worked for the company. It wasn't simply the bottom line, but they certainly wanted to disseminate the ability to get things done. And it almost as if every employee was important. That's sort of an unusual thing, especially today when we see them laying off people, a Circuit City getting $11 an hour, so they'll come back and work for $8 an hour.
Yeah, I was struck that all the way through, if there was one defining term that made Hewlett and Packard different from almost every other executives I had ever encountered.
Hold that thought right there. Well, I guess it's Mike Malone. He's telling us why Hewlett Packard Corporation was different. Go ahead.
there's one term that defines these guys more than any other executives I've ever come across. And I've interviewed basically all of them over the years for the New York Times and for ABC and the Mercury News and a number of other publications. It's that Bill and Dave trusted their people, and they built Hewlett-Packard around the notion of trust, that they trusted people all the way down to the receptionist and the file clerk and the janitor. And because of that trust, because they trusted each other, it began with the trust they had for each other. They could walk away from HP and leave it in the hands of the other guy for years at a time. That trust imbued the entire corporation, and that's what made HP unbeatable. And when that trust was finally broken in the years after their deaths, that's when HP got into a lot of trouble. And now that HP's coming back, in a large part, it's built upon the restoration of that trust as embodied in what's called the HP Way, which is maybe the most famous corporate culture in the world.
And you talk about the fact that it was built upon the character of the two men who created it.
Yeah, you know, if there's anything I've learned over the years as a reporter, it's that ultimately companies can have wonderful products, they can have charismatic CEOs, they can own their markets, but eventually they get to a crisis. And when that crisis comes, it's a test of the corporation's character. And ultimately that's the sum of the character of all the people that work there. And when they reach those character tests, an awful lot of companies fail. For example, look at the news right now about Dell Computer. There's a great company, great products, was bestriding the landscape, owned the personal computer industry. And now over the last year, that company seems to be snake bit. They seem to make one mistake after another. They can't seem to do anything right. They're losing market share. Even the gods seem to be turning against them. I mean, when their laptop computers catch on fire because of a bad Sony power supply, who gets blamed? Dell. And the company can't seem to get out of its own existential crisis. And I think that's a character test. I think Microsoft has gone through that recently. I think Apple went through it a few years ago. So it really is, corporations have good characters and bad characters. And I think HP is, at least between 1957 and 1974, I really think Hewlett-Packard might have been the greatest company there's ever been. And that was all about character.
And, of course, you know, well, my wife was commenting this evening about her Hewlett-Packard printer. She's had it for 20 years, and it's still going right just as strong as it possibly can.
Yeah, in the 1970s, when HP introduced its calculators,
we're going to be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and the title, is it Bill and Dave or Dave and Bill?
It's usually Bill and Dave.
Bill and Dave, okay, that's what I thought. Anyway, Bill and Dave, and it's a fascinating story of Hewlett-Packard. And of course, Mike was talking about when Hewlett-Packard introduced its calculators. Pick that story up.
Well, at the time, I was just out of college, and I happened to be working for HP. And one of my jobs was to write stories about HP calculators. And what I discovered as I researched was that HP calculators had become quite famous for how tough they were. And I was encountering stories of HP calculators being bounced off the back of motorcycles at 75 miles an hour, being accidentally dropped over the side of a boat into a lake that froze over during the winter and was dug out, and all it needed was a new battery. Calculators being taken out of buckets of molten tar where the case had melted, but all the guts inside still worked. I mean, that's a level of quality. And I don't think HP has it now. I think it's trying to get back to it. But that's a level of quality that goes beyond just providing a product that people, you know, find acceptable. That's taking it to a level of trust with your customer. I mean, that's a social contract that we don't see very often.
Yeah, of course, really, they started out, you know, at the very beginning of this whole electronic era, and, you know, the calculator, and then pretty soon along comes these other things. Weren't they in oscilloscopes and things like that?
Yeah, in fact, oscilloscopes was the one thing they actually got beat at. Tektronix up in Oregon always stayed ahead of HP. It was a source of great frustration for the company. HP actually goes back, if you look at the story of Bill and Dave, it's sort of the template. I've seen it over and over again. It's the template for almost every high-tech entrepreneur. The classic starting out in the garage. I mean, the first garage is the Packard garage. The startup company, going public, then you build the global corporation, then you go to Washington to in public service, and then you become a great philanthropist in your old age. That pattern was really created by Hewlett and Packard, especially by Packard. And everybody has seemed to try to follow its sense, including Bill Gates. What's interesting is no one has really done it as well as those two guys did, and they were the first. So they're the archetypes.
All right, and of course, then, of course, along comes the computer and then the printer and all of these things, and they're just having to constantly work, you know, to be on the front lines of this whole electronic industry.
That's one of the interesting things I've learned about great corporations is that they're not really sentimental about the past. Packard was famous for being utterly indifferent to products that had made him a very wealthy man. He never went back to the famous garage, except when it was made into a state historic site. He refused to go back. He said there's no point in looking back. Even in his 80s, when people sat around and wanted to talk about the good old days of HP, he wanted to talk about the Monterey Aquarium. So he was always looking forward, and great companies do the same thing. They reinvent themselves to meet a changing marketplace, and they don't hang on to the past. If Hewlett and Packard were intensely loyal to their employees, but they were never loyal to their products, and I think that's the mark of great CEOs.
And of course, you actually had an opportunity to interview both of them, didn't you?
Yes, I met both of them, and I helped Packard with his autobiography in his final years. So I got a chance to see him right before the end.
And of course, fabulously wealthy, but they were not necessarily people really in it for the wealth, were they?
No, and most of the important entrepreneurs that I've ever met, the money is a side benefit. It's really more of a measurement scheme to see how well they've done. People that go in it strictly for the money usually don't get it.
But of course, they were in it for the idealism, and really, because it's a fascinating story, meeting on a football field. Is that really a true story? They were sitting together on the bench there at Stanford back in 1930?
Yeah, they were both going out for the Stanford freshman football team. You have to keep in mind, Dave Packard was about 6'5", huge man, a tremendous athlete. He was a three-letter man at Stanford. He set all the track records at the Little Big Meet, I think it's called, and he played in the Rose Bowl and played basketball. So he was really kind of this godlike character. While Bill Hewlett was short and squat and dyslexic, mainly got into Stanford because his father had been dean of the medical school and had died when Bill was about 10 years old. So they were very, very different. They both went out for the football team. Packard made it easily, and Hewlett got cut. And then they had a number of classes together in their undergraduate years, but really had a different sets of friends. And it was only in grad school, even though they'd known each other for about five or six years, the friendship really got started. And it was based on common interests, starting a company on high tech, on electronics, and those kinds of things. So it was a very interesting friendship. And there's only a few records of them ever having an argument. For 60 years, they seem to trust each other completely. And that's one of the miracles of that partnership.
Yeah, but of course, Silicon Valley is one of the most amazing phenomena, you know, really in the world. And here was really the center of this whole electronic industry that's really transformed the world.
Yes, and one of the ironies is that Hewlett-Packard, even though it's at the center of Silicon Valley, and it's at the beginning of Silicon Valley, in strange ways isn't of Silicon Valley. The Valley is really entrepreneurial. It's very cutthroat. It's very product-oriented, technology-oriented. And Hewlett and Packard, I like to show the contradictions, the oppositions between HP and the rest of Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley is hard-driving young people, technologists, out to make, you know, a huge mark. Hewlett-Packard is a company where people stay for 30 years. They're den mothers and scoutmasters and PTA presidents. It's a whole different feel. So in some respects, Silicon Valley and HP are diametric opposites, and yet at the same time, there's a symbiotic relationship. Silicon Valley needs HP to be healthy, and HP needs Silicon Valley to keep things moving.
As you get into the book, you get into what's happened, in more recent years, the struggle there, to try to get back to this, the HP way was the term you used, the HP way, and of course the new leadership there, a couple of instances of new leadership and all sorts of scandals there, and so do you want to touch on that at all?
Sure. One of the tragedies of Hewlett-Packard is that Bill and Dave did just about everything right except for one thing, and that was succession. They thought they had the right guy, and his name was John Young. He did a good job. The company continued to grow, but it began to exhibit some of the symptoms of growing old. And Hewlett-Packard, despite being very old men, were very young men at heart, in that sense of not looking back and always looking forward. And a lot of the culture of Hewlett-Packard began to become sclerotic and rigid. And so instead of this dynamic corporate culture, it became these simple sets of rules that everybody thought were true, like HP never fires anybody. We hold a lot of meetings. We have to have everybody sign off on everything before we make a move. And those sounded right, but in fact they were antithetical to what Bill and David built. So HP began slowing down in the 80s and then into the 90s, and then the nadir was really reached when the board of directors, feeling like the company was in bad shape, basically threw a Hail Mary. They went out to find somebody from the outside, mistake number one, who would make the place, who would bring some life back to Hewlett-Packard and stir things up. And so instead of trusting the employees to find their way out, which Bill and Dave had always done, they had, whenever the company began to slow down, they turned to the companies and said, let's fight our way back out. Instead, they went to somebody on the outside, and that was Carly Fiorina, a very bright lady, very talented, tremendous business strategist, but she didn't have a clue about the HP corporate culture. She didn't have any of that trust that Bill and David had, and she essentially turned Hewlett-Packard into a disaster area. And we saw the company employees began to mutiny when the company went out to buy Compaq. The HP employees, in a famous proxy fight, actually voted against their own CEO. And eventually, Fiorina was driven out of the company. But by then, there was such a culture of paranoia throughout the firm, and especially at the board, that when leaks began to occur, the chairman, Patricia Dunn, essentially gave carte blanche to detective firms to find out who was leaking. And they went completely off the reservation, began to break laws with pretexting and digging into reporters' notes and everything else, and we saw the huge scandal that resulted from that last summer.
And, of course, what's going to happen now as far as HP? Because we've actually lost two CEOs here in not too long a period of time. Who's at the helm now, and are they going to get back to the old ways?
Well, interestingly, I did a big Q&A interview with the current CEO, Mark Hurd, for the Wall Street Journal a couple weeks ago. And Hurd's an interesting guy. He comes from NCR. He's a Midwestern guy. He's kind of a tough guy. He came in skeptical about the HP way, in much the same way Fiorina had been. The difference was, when he hit HP, the smartest thing he did was he just shut up. He stopped talking to the outside world and just talked to employees. And as a result, he actually began to understand the HP way. And HP's begun a massive turnaround. It is now the world's largest electronics company, and the largest in history, $100 billion. And it has now passed Dell as number one in personal computers. And that's all happened in about the last 20 months. So HP's back.
Well, it's an amazing, amazing story, and there's a lot to be learned, I think, for anybody, of course, who's an entrepreneur who's going to be running a company. But this is the history of what may be, many people believe, is certainly the world's greatest corporation. We'll be back in just a moment with Mr. Mike Malone here at Radio Liberty. Well, Mike, of course, I'm sure it must have been loads of fun to write your book and certainly to have an opportunity to talk to all of these people. What can we learn from the book? Why is your book important? Because there are lots of books on HP. It's not the first book that's been written about it, but it's different than other books, isn't it?
Yeah. To get back to the fun part, I enjoyed every second of writing this book. Compared to, I've written about a dozen books over the years of history and business theory, and some fun, some not. HP was just a joy to write. And I had worked there many years ago, but in the last 10 years, because of some of the things I had written in the Wall Street Journal and a few other places, I was pretty much persona non grata there. So to see HP come back and to see the culture return and to be able to go back there and see people I knew 20 years ago and see them happy again and proud to be working for the company once more was really quite thrilling. Now, the lessons of Hewlett-Packard, of Bill and Dave, they're really simple lessons, but they're extraordinarily difficult. I actually have a piece coming out in the journal in another week or two we uncovered David Packard's 11 simple rules. But if there was one thing, it's integrity. These two men build a company on integrity. It's an old-fashioned word. They build a company with character. When one of their biggest computer products that had cost them billions of dollars to develop was dead on arrival when it was shipped out to customers, they went out and got every one of them back and built them again and redesigned the product and sent it back out to them. They took a huge loss on that. It wasn't about publicity or anything else. It was the right thing to do. Integrity, character, and trust. We hear that a lot in corporate. CEOs say that in speeches. We see it in corporate mission statements. But to actually build a company on trust and to trust every single person to do the right thing takes enormous amounts of courage, and it takes enormous amounts of character in the CEO. And a lot of companies give lip service to it, but these guys actually did it. And the wonderful thing about Hewlett and Packard is that they stand there as this shining example that anybody can do this. It can be done. You don't have to cut corners. You don't have to do sleazy business practices. If these guys can do it, and not only do it well, but end up on top, then why take the bad route? Why do shoddy business practices? Why rip off your customers? They always stand there as that model. Everybody in Silicon Valley has to glance over their shoulder and look at those two guys and say they did it right and they won, so why shouldn't we do it right?
Well, now what about the globalization? What about this idea of offshoring? So much of the work I know with my Hewlett-Packard printer, my little $100 printer, you know, of course, when I'm going to get it worked, get a consultation on it, it's over in India. They've got somebody in India named Raj, you know, who's telling me what's wrong with my computer. It's amazing how they can do that. They have somebody by telephone, but the telephone actually checks my computer. He looks on the screen and says, "We'll have something over there to get it fixed tomorrow for you," or something of the sort.
Mm-hmm.
So are they staying onshore? Are they beginning to move offshore, as many of the other corporations are, to be able to be competitive in this global world?
I think it's a little bit of both. Watching globalization in Silicon Valley, one of the things I've noticed is that a lot of the basic activities are getting moved offshore.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment with Mike Malone. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and simply talking to Mike Malone. And, of course, his book is Bill and Dave. And it's the story, of course, of Hewlett-Packard. But it's an amazing story. It's this background of the individuals, you know, their background. But it's much more than biographies of the men who created it. It gets into the very spirit of this corporation that separates it from all other corporations. And so we were just talking about what's happening is globalization, because certainly this is changing the corporate structure and, of course, the business structure all throughout America. So are they beginning to be forced, as far as manufacturing, to move some of their production offshore?
Well, the simple answer is that HP went offshore almost before any other electronics company. There was HP in Scotland, there was HP in France, And HP was actually the first U.S. electronics company to operate in Japan. So HP's, in a sense, always been out there. As for the challenge of globalization, I've written a fair amount on that in the past on my column I have for ABC. And the more I think about it, the more I'm absolutely convinced that globalization presents a very specific challenge, and that is you either have to stay ahead of the curve or you fall back into the morass of having to compete with much cheaper labor everywhere else in the world. And so the greatest advantage that we have is maintaining this culture we have in the Valley and other technology enclaves of entrepreneurial endeavors, of high levels of education, of a strong patent system, investments in R&D. You can't fight the fight of the, you can't fight old products. If you do, then you're going to be up against people all over the world that are getting one-tenth your salary. The only way you compete is like Google, where you create a brand new company with a fundamentally new business paradigm in a brand new market, and you own it. And as long as places like Silicon Valley can keep generating new companies like that and innovative new products, we'll stay ahead. If we ever poison the environment, the culture of innovation we have, and we did a pretty good job over the last few years with Sarbanes-Oxley of destroying the IPO market, the ability of new startups to go public. If we keep poisoning the process of entrepreneurship in this country, we will fall back and end up having to slug it out in the mud with a lot less expensive workers around the world.
Now, how did we actually destroy the IPO market? What were you speaking of specifically?
There's two things. One of them is these all came out of the dot-com bubble and Enron and a lot of the big scandals. Typically, Congress will react to the last scandal by trying to change regulations. After the cow's out of the barn, they try to change the rules. And oftentimes, that makes things worse for the next time around. And two things occurred. One of them was full disclosure, and full disclosure is the notion that there's a whole new set of regulations corporations have to do about their activities, especially at the level of the board of directors. The other one, and that, by the way, was what got HP into trouble with this scandal. Patricia Dunn was so concerned about the feds coming down on full disclosure over these leaks that's why she started the witch hunt, basically, that led to the scandals. The other thing is a law called Sarbanes-Oxley. And what that does is it requires a massive level of reporting being done by public corporations. It costs them in the millions of dollars every year. And it's so expensive and it's so onerous to do that most new startup companies now never, ever intend to go public. They don't want to mess with all of that. So what they do now, if you've noticed, 5 years ago, a couple hundred companies in Silicon Valley went public in 1 year. This year, I think it's under 30. So the traditional business model here has shifted, and now everybody's, if you look at every business plan in Silicon Valley of a new company, it says on the last page, sell to Google or sell to Yahoo. All these exciting new startups now, their goal is to never go public, but just sell the company out to one of the existing firms. And I think that's going to hurt us badly in the long term. It's giving a lot of power, maybe too much power, over the marketplace to the Googles and the Yahoos of the world, and not creating that refreshing upwelling of exciting new firms.
And, of course, whatever the government does, why, of course, there's always unintended consequences. Oh, my goodness, we're from the government. We're here to help. We're here to protect you, people, common people, from your own folly. And of course, every new regulation seems to get us into more and more trouble. Would you concur that at least that's partly true?
I'll tell you this, the London Stock Exchange, they joke that they ought to put two statues up out front, the Mr. Sarbanes and Mr. Oxley, because it has shifted billions, even trillions of dollars of capital from the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ to the London Stock Exchange.
Hold that thought, we'll be back here in just a moment, and then we'll see how long you can stay with us, or we're going to have to let you go. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest has been Mike Malone, and of course his book is Bill and Dave. How can people get hold of your book?
Oh, anywhere. Amazon, Borders. It's just about everywhere.
All right, fine. And do you have a website or anything you'd like to get out, or do we have to go to Wall Street Journal or the other publications to read
your
article?
Well, if you want to read my regular writing, the best place to go to is abcnews.com, and I have a column there called The Silicon Insider. I've been doing that for about 4 years. And then about once a month, I have an editorial or an interview in the Wall Street Journal.
All right, fine. Well, we certainly enjoyed it. Well, they said only 30 minutes, so I don't want to keep you here. It's late at night, unless you want to take some questions from callers.
Do you have any callers?
Well, we don't have them, but I can put the message out here as soon as we take the callers on. And I just don't want to take advantage of you because you know how busy you are. But if you're out there in the listening audience, I want to give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, although I don't think we'll get any callers for about 2 minutes until we suddenly bring all of our stations back on board with us. We take these breaks and run commercials to them, and so the only people who are hearing this would be the people in our local station here in the Monterey Bay area. But anyway, of course, I think it's fascinating. Well, certainly, is there going to be any way around this? Because the other thing that concerns me is they're going to change the tax laws in Washington, D.C. And you basically have to have, you know, low taxation to make it worthwhile for people to be willing to take the chance and work hard and invest. But if you're going to tax away everything they're going to make, why, of course, they're not going to be working so hard.
I think the great unwritten story is that when we cut capital gains, the capital gains tax differential, when we cut that, we set off one of the greatest new business creation booms in the history of the world. The United States is the most powerful and successful economy ever. And almost every one of those new jobs that we've created, those hundreds of thousands, millions of new jobs we've created in the last 20 years, have come from entrepreneurial endeavors. Big existing giant Fortune 500 companies don't create new jobs. Exciting new companies, ones we haven't heard of before. 15 years ago, no one had heard of Google. It didn't exist. Or eBay. Or Amazon. These companies now employ tens of thousands of people and generate billions of dollars of wealth. And if we throttle that goose that lays the golden eggs, if we destroy entrepreneurial startups in the United States, our economy will fall behind really fast, astonishingly fast. We will lose our edge.
Well, I hope Nancy Pelosi is listening and the others are, because I'm afraid that's just what they're going to do.
I fear the same thing.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Mike Malone, and Mike writes for the Wall Street Journal and for ABC, and he's written all sorts of fascinating books. Well, anyway, if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question for Mike, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, and we have Herman on the line. Hi, Herman. Do you have a question for our guest?
Yes, fascinating evening. Thank you for being our guest. Two questions regarding China and India. Are you concerned about their rise in power and the technology marketplace? And what about
just one question.
Okay.
So what about China and India, and what about their challenging America in the technology marketplace?
I'm quite ambivalent about both countries. On the one hand, both have enormous structural problems. Obviously, China has the party and the nomenclatura running the show, and they've allowed a certain degree of capitalism, but it could snap back at any time. And I'm not sure how long you can run a capitalist communist country. At some point, there's going to have to be an explosion. India is a different challenge. India has the problem that essentially you have five eras of human civilization coexisting there. You have people that are, they have a million debt bondage slaves still in India. You have pre-agrarian people, agrarian people, early manufacturing, industrial age people, all the way up to those tens of thousands of students going to IIT in Bangalore. So I think they're going to have enormous social challenges coming very soon. Bangalore is absolutely screaming as an economy. That we've begun to see some interesting flaws in that system. One of them is that they're producing huge numbers of engineers, both India and China. But the quality of those engineers, which we thought were pretty high, there's some second thoughts now. If the really cutting-edge stuff can... If the students being produced by China and India are really out there at the cutting edge, right now we seem to still have the best engineers.
All right, well, I'm so glad to hear that. Anything else, Sherman?
Well, the other question I've heard, Israel, tiny little Israel, seems to be producing some cutting-edge things in the world marketplace.
And certainly in technology. What are your thoughts about Israel? We see that here if Warren Buffett has actually invested, I don't know, $3 or $4 billion in Israel, even though it appears that Israel's maybe on the verge of a major conflict. And Warren Buffett's a pretty smart fellow. So what are your thoughts about Israel and their industrial potential?
Israel's been a huge electronics powerhouse now for about 40 years. Very few people have noticed, but an awful lot of the chip design work for companies like Intel has been done in Israel now for decades. They have a very robust economy with a lot of entrepreneurs, and on top of that, because of their military innovation, the fact they have to constantly come up with new weapon systems to survive against their neighbors, there's an awful lot of defense spin-offs that have led to a number of startup companies. So, yeah, Israel is really important in the great scheme of things when it comes to technology. Interestingly, when it comes to software code and encryption and those sort of things, parts of Russia and the Baltic countries produce some of the best code writers in the world. So we see these interesting little pockets of talent springing up in oftentimes unlikely places.
Okay, fine. Thanks very much, Herman. And let's go to Bob calling from Yuma, Arizona. And again, our number 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Hi, Bob. Did you have a question for our guest?
Yeah, I could just barely hear you, though.
Oh, go ahead.
I was just curious if HP was ever going to catch up with Tektronix on the oscilloscopes.
Well, I think in that battle, it was one of those situations where the battles were all won by Tektronix, but HP, I think, won the war because the technology has now moved so far beyond traditional oscilloscopes that into these advanced, complex, multi-process
digital
systems.
Well, let me explain to you. I had to take care of the electro-optical servicing of helicopter electronic blade tracking devices, and so I'd use a Tektronix scope to view the eyeballs of the blade tracker.
Okay, and so they really had a better product, is what you're saying.
Basically, Tektronix, the guy who founded Tektronix was actually a good friend of Bill and Dave. And they helped him get going. And Tektronix hit the marketplace with such a brilliant design for an oscilloscope. They beat HP, and HP tried to get into that market and played catch-up, chasing Tektronix for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
Never succeeded. It was a source of huge frustration at HP, because HP had essentially beaten every other competitor it ever run up against, except maybe IBM and mini computers, but little Tektronix always seemed to win in the oscilloscope wars. But in the last 10, 15 years, oscilloscopes have evolved into something entirely different, so it's not really a market anymore. But there's one battle HP lost.
Okay, fine. Thanks very much for calling, Bob. And caller just called off the air, didn't want to come on, but they wondered about this thing of industrial espionage, people coming over here and really, Chris, trying to get these electronic secrets, which, of course, have made Silicon Valley so unique and able to stay a couple of steps ahead of so many of the other countries like China and elsewhere. What about the industrial espionage going on over there?
It's been going on since the 1960s. In fact, I was lucky enough to be part of a team that did the original series on espionage in Silicon Valley for the San Jose Mercury News. The fact of the matter is our friends and our enemies have listening posts all over Silicon Valley trying to gather information and try to get heads up on new products. The Japanese have done it. The French have done it. The Chinese are doing it. The Soviets did it. Everybody does it. Everybody wants to get a piece of the magic here.
You know, I think it's the most amazing thing that, I mean, here really, what drives the Silicon Valley? But it's really the advantage of, you know, wanting to accomplish something, to be able to build something new, to make a profit. If you take the profit out, why, of course, people are not going to work as hard. Now, certainly is, I'm sure, idealism in this, but you've got to reward people. You reward people, you get what you reward. If you want people to work hard, boy, you let them make money. If you want to get them on welfare, you give them a lot of welfare. You get what you subsidize, and they can do that with the tax structure.
Well, let me tell you an anecdote. Hewlett Packard is famous for having come up with these corporate objectives. When we talk about management by objective, that comes from Hewlett Packard in the late 1950s. They came up with a list of a handful, about six corporate objectives. And when the team, the task force, came up with this list, they originally had number one, contribution, meaning contribution to society and that sort of thing from HP's products. And Packard looked at it and said, no. Number one is profit. You look at this company, number one goal is profit. Everything after that follows. So when we talk about these guys being enlightened, they were also, and humanistic executives, keep in mind, they understood that profit comes before anything because profit funds everything. You can be, if you want to be an enlightened CEO, then have a successful company.
And, of course, if you're making enough profit, then you can do all these humanitarian things. But if you don't have any profit, why, you're going to go right down the tubes.
Yeah, and I think, and profit often, you know, gets presented as a dirty word sometimes. But, in fact, profit is a measure of your effectiveness. If you're doing a good job and you're producing a quality product, then you can price it at a point. The market will pay a price that rewards you with an acceptable profit that enables you to go on and do the next generation. If you're not doing a good enough job, then you're not going to make enough profits. So just as entrepreneurs see their accumulation of wealth as a measurement scheme for how good of a job they're doing, corporations, by the same token, profit is a measure of how good a job they're doing.
Well, of course, the patent laws actually protect our industries throughout the world.
To a degree, the patent system, which is one of the glories of the United States. In fact, I think Abraham Lincoln thought the two most important American creations were the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. patent law system. The patent system has gotten pretty clunky in the last 10 or 15 years. It used to be very easy and very inexpensive to file for a patent. Now it's becoming increasingly expensive and hugely competitive. You have to hire very good lawyers. You can't just file one patent anymore. You got to file 20 or 30 to cover every little nuance of what you're doing, or it'll get picked away by other companies doing patents. There's a major revolution due in the U.S. patent system pretty soon, and there's going to have to be a lot more enforcement of pirating around the world.
All right. Well, what about the Chinese? Do they really respect our patent laws at all? Are they just going to go ahead and do whatever they want to? Because, after all, certainly they're not based upon a rule of law. They're not based upon the rule of morality. It's success that measures whether they win or not.
Yeah, I think countries will obey or disobey patent laws based upon what they think is important for their national goals and what they think they can get away with. An awful lot of those countries in the Far East, the Four Tigers in China, are pretty sloppy about protecting patent rights. And I think that will come back to bite them at some point.
In what way? After all, if they're able to copy our products and turn them out at a cheaper price, you know, that would seem to be, at least in the world market based upon price, and so much really we see, certainly Walmart represents, you know, you buy it at Walmart because it's cheap, and it's, many times it's really quite good quality. So how is it going to come back and bite them, do you think?
Well, remember, in a longer view, the longer waves of history, we go through periods of free trade and then reaction and protectionism. And at some point, if you can't sell your products without them getting you can't sell your products on the world stage without them getting stolen, then countries are going to start throwing up protectionist barriers, which is the absolute worst-case scenario. And we go back to, the 1920s, and everybody's going to... If we don't figure out a way to fix this, everyone's going to get punished by a global depression, just like we did in the 1920s, by throwing up so much protection that every economy became a walled fortress and trade stopped.
Well, let me ask you a question just a little bit on a little different line. Now, right now, of course, we're shipping so many of our manufacturing jobs overseas, and if it's just a straight manufacturing job, I mean, there's no way we can compete with China or with India or certainly with Malaysia or with South Korea. But, so certainly Dr. Alan Binder there at Princeton, the economist, has said we stand to lose about 40 million jobs. And he's concerned about where our jobs are going to come from in the future. Certainly we can't, get 40 million jobs in electronics, so where are the jobs going to come from, and will this lead to a demand for tariff barriers again?
I'm not sure I agree with the 40 million lost. I think we're going to constantly lose, we will constantly and continuously lose millions of jobs offshore, and I don't know how you stop that. If you try to stem the outflow of work, then you make our companies less competitive. Ultimately, and I keep coming back to this, I don't know any other way to square that circle. It's you have to keep innovating. You have to innovate your way out of the potential doldrums of where you're stuck in this stasis where you're not moving forward and you're bleeding jobs all over the world. The only way to get out of that is to create new industries, new products, new markets, and it's not just technology. Though technology is now the largest manufacturing employer in the United States, it's all the things that spin off from that. So is Amazon a technology company? Well, yeah, it's an internet company, but it's selling books, and it's a retailer now. It's selling household goods, and you have the secondary effect of business going to publishing companies and appliance makers and all of that. So if you can keep moving forward, and that argues once again for a wide-open economy, support for entrepreneurs, the ability to go public, getting regulations out of the way of entrepreneurs, and getting back to creating a streamlined, hard-charging, innovative society that can stay one step ahead of everybody else.
And that, of course, requires low taxes and maximum benefits for the individual.
Yes.
And of course, let's just hope and pray that the Democrats in their zeal to attack the rich don't create a monster that's going to plunge us into a terrible, terrible recession. That's my
opinion. And that always surprises me because ultimately, it's about individual freedom. The more freedom you give people to construct their own lives, the more likely they are to construct good, productive lives. And why wouldn't you empower people to invent things and build enterprises and create jobs and do all those things? It seems to me obvious, and yet so many people out there are much more interested in preserving the pie as it is and getting a larger slice of it than actually baking a bigger pie.
Amen to that. Well, I certainly agree with you. Well, Mike, it's getting late. I really want you to know how much I appreciate you staying with us this evening. A fascinating book. It's Bill and Dave, and I hope our listeners will get it. A great read, and it gives you tremendous insight into really one of the great miracles of modern times, a corporation built upon character and integrity, which is so unusual in times like this.
Well, thank you, and I'll see you at the beach.
Okay, good night. Well, if you get down here, you can always look it up. We are Radio Liberty, and, of course, we're a small independent radio station here, but, of course, we have this program is heard on certainly close to a dozen stations across the country. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Good night. All right, fine. Well, that was Mike Malone, and he was very gracious to come and spend some time with us. If you have a question or comment, our telephone number 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But I think that Mike's point is so well made. You have people in Washington, D.C. who see a problem, and what they want to do is pass a law. And every time you pass a law, why, you get unintended consequences. And it may not have been meant that at all. You remember when we wanted to do something about air pollution? So they were going to solve the problem of air pollution from gasoline emissions by adding MTBE to the gasoline to stop air pollution. We not only then increased air pollution, we polluted the water. And then, of course, it took us years to undo all the harm that had been done. Now, of course, we're going to put in ethanol. Ethanol is the solution. We're going to add that to our gasoline. And, of course, this actually breaks down into all sorts of toxic substances that will, of course, going to have a terrible impact on air. It'll produce far more pollution than regular gasoline would. But, of course, now it's been mandated by our government, which is subsidizing ethanol. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and we're just talking about really, of course, what happens so often is as we have our legislators seeing the problem that they, a societal problem, and then, of course, well, what are we going to do about it? Well, of course, the ideal solution to the problem of the shortage of oil here and our dependence upon foreign oil would be to allow drilling up at Anwar, off the north slope of Alaska, where there's far more oil than there is in Saudi Arabia and Iran and Iraq all put together. And if you think that sounds incredible, actually I've checked the story with people who were working there when they were actually building the pipeline. And if you haven't got our 4-tape set on oil, and of course Lindsay Williams' book, The Energy Non-Crisis, or read my 2 articles on the internet on oil, and they're available there at radioliberty.com. Let me suggest that you do that and then get our 4-tape set and then get Lindsay Williams' book, and you'll find out that the world is awash with oil. And the only reason, of course, we got shortages is because they're man-made. They've been created by the environmental movement. Oh, we can't drill up at Anwar, the pristine wilderness. Ladies and gentlemen, there's nothing up there except a tundra, and it's frozen over most of the year. And the only time you ever see the ground at all is maybe for a month or so, in the springtime. And the rest of the year, why, of course, it's just covered with ice. And, of course, about the only occupants of that area are reindeer, and there are a few Eskimos. And they're desperate for jobs. They'd love to have drilling up in that area. But, of course, the reason we don't drill in Anwar, it's because they don't want to solve the problem. And you have to get back to basic economics. If you have an abundance of something, the price goes down. If you have a shortage, the price goes up. Do you think the oil companies make more money if there's an abundance of oil or a shortage of oil? And I'd like to suggest that they've created all sorts of artificial shortages. We went into Iraq, of course, to make sure there was plenty of oil. And when George Bush became president, oil was $18 a barrel. What is oil today? How much was a gallon of gasoline back in the year 2001? How much is a gallon of gas today? And remember, of course, George Bush comes from an oil family. And, of course, his Vice President Cheney, comes from Halliburton. And they even pay Dick Cheney a deferred salary. Isn't that nice to know? Some people might call it a bribe, but I want you to know it's not. It's simply a deferred salary to Dick Cheney. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and I hope you enjoyed our interview with Mike Malone. I was pleased he was able to stay on. He was only supposed to be with us for 30 minutes, but I think he was intrigued by our callers and certainly by somebody who had some idea what he was trying to say in his book. It's a great book about an amazing time period. And we just hope that we can preserve this spirit of entrepreneurship in Silicon Valley that has been responsible really for tremendous advances in our living standards, and of course for the electronic revolution, which has impacted upon the lives of each and every one of you, and actually even from the point of view of what I do. From the point of view of a communicator who is trying to educate people, the Internet is by far the most inexpensive and certainly one of the most efficient means of reaching people. If we reach people all across America, indeed all across the world, by the miracle of the Internet, and certainly dollar by dollar, it costs only a fraction of what shortwave or certainly in the getting onto privately owned radio stations cost. However, of course, we do get on those radio stations so that we can get people to learn about our shortwave and about our Internet programs and to introduce them to these ideas we put forward. So even though the Internet's the best way to do it and the most economical, why people aren't going to get onto the Internet and go to Radio Liberty unless, of course, either you tell them or they hear us on one of the radio stations. And so often people will be simply surfing the dial in the Los Angeles Basin or in Northern California. We cover California quite well, upstate New York, eastern Washington. I wish we covered the whole country that well. But we are reaching people. We know that more and more people are listening, and of course more and more people are learning about the spiritual battle which is behind the political, ideological, and cultural battle that is being fought in the world today. Well, let me simply mention that our efforts are largely financed by those of you in the listening audience who believe in what we're doing, and if you'd like to either join the Radio Liberty family supporters or help us, why, we'd love to hear from you. And our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888, our telephone number to contact us is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And if you would really like to understand the true nature of the spiritual battle, you need to talk, you need to get my book and or DVD or the Brotherhood of Darkness special, the book Brotherhood of Darkness, the DVD and video Brotherhood of Darkness, and then of course the audio tape, and you get them all together as a special if you're interested. And then you certainly would want to get my talk on The Forbidden Secret, because The Forbidden Secret is really an amazing story. You see, the great teachers and philosophers of the past, when they had students, would had their average students, and most of their students, they told one story. But to a very select few, they would tell the secret. And that secret then was passed down by philosophers and teachers and sages and priests and prophets down through the ages for 5,000 years. From the Assyrians and the Egyptians and the Babylonians into the mystery religions and certainly the Magi. And of course, then of course through the Kabbalah and the Gnosticism, and then of course through the Knights Templar and the Rosicrucians, down to modern day Masonry and the Illuminati and the other secret societies of modern times, Theosophy, the Lucis Trust. And there is a secret, if we tell you, in the DVD entitled Forbidden Secret. It will change the way you look at the world. If you're interested in knowing more, our telephone number 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we hope that you pray for America, you pray for revival, but please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And then, of course, please go to our website of RadioLiberty.com. And you can listen to us 5 hours a day at Global Star.
Tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.